Thank you very much. Can I now also call on Dr. Kotenko and Dr. Galper to come to the stage and we can call some take some questions. And while Dr. Kotenko and Dr. Galper are coming up, we'd like to ask to you, we have a lot of clinical data, and you also talked about clinical acumen. Do you see, but there's also a lot of different data actually around there, which are on a busy clinical round, not so easy to interpret. Do you see a role there for algorithms, for artificial intelligence in the future to help you in a way? Can you respond to that? Have there been trials around this?
So maybe Perry Wilson at Yale is actually has an R01 right now and has a trial, I'm forgetting the acronym, but he's rolled it out at four of the Yale hospitals where he's using a machine learning algorithm that's using all the clinical variables, no novel biomarkers, to detect incipient AKI, like a 48-hour rolling time window that their patient's at high risk. And he's using clinical decision support then to alert people to do something about it. So we'll see. I think we need to see that evidence, because if you guys Google it, I think Perry had, it's F. Perry Wilson, but he had a paper in Lancet when he was still at Penn. This was two or three years ago. They did a trial of text message alerts to the pagers, I guess, for AKI. And, I mean, the primary outcome, it was like 26% and 26%. It was exactly equal. People did not, it did not help outcomes at all with acute kidney injury. So I'm a skeptic by and large on a lot of things, and I want to see the evidence before we jump in and follow the hype. So even AI here in this setting needs to be proven, but at least someone's doing it, and we'll see.
Yeah, please.
I think we are in an opportunity in North America that we need to put the EMR that we've been embedded with to our use. Some programs, I know Cincinnati Children's example, has a panel now of things that comes up with a high-risk flag. And it doesn't make sense now with Epic and Cerner, which are the two bigger, and there's a lot of other ones out there, that there could not be some investment in some of these red flags. The difficulty is, are the clinicians ordering the tests that are maybe helpful? And we all know the phosphorus is not on the comp. We know the uric, in my case, uric acid is not commonly drawn. But, could we come up with a true EMR flag that would help clinical practice? And I think that would be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Perry's essentially using the EMR variables to input this, and people, experts have said that 10 years from now, we're going to look back at this era of medicine and say we were committing malpractice by not harnessing all the EMR-based data and constantly analyzing and trying to refine. Just like Amazon and Google and whatever apps we have are tracking us, and you get those ads pop on your phone and they know where you were and they know your time to home, right? They're all tracking us, and it should be an imperative mandate that in medicine we try to use all that data at our disposal now that the high computing capacity is there. Peter does a lot of machine learning too, and really ingest it, analyze it, learn from it, use it, and improve practice and improve outcomes. Right?
Okay, thank you. We go now the first question to allohemodialysis, and for Peter Kotenko. Allohemodialysis sounds interesting. Between the actual cost of procedures, time of volunteer, how is the cost of allohemodialysis as compared to conventional hemodialysis?
Yeah. Okay, now this is, of course, a critical question. We don't have real hard data on that. We have data from one Indian province where this was actually calculated, and it looks very favorable towards allo-HD. We have also first data about the costs of the actual machine, because, of course, you need a machine to pump the blood and so on. And I can, without going into the details, but it's at least one order of magnitude less expensive. And it depends also on the setting. I mean, in a chronic setting, I think this method could be applied at home, say, in a family, so the whole infrastructure costs that come with dialysis facilities would be less. And so these are the health economic analyses on the larger scale underway.
Dr. Bob, what do you think about it?
I had the pleasure of having a personal presentation by Peter on this. And so, Peter, I want to ask you a few questions, one that Jay asked me. To me, the ethical issue is over. I would do this for my grandchildren like that. It's over, okay? Now it's up to you to see that it can be done. So some of the questions are, in resource-limited areas, you're probably going to need either electricity or batteries to run the blood pumps. And so we have to understand the kinetics, the fluid kinetics of the blood pumps. That's key. Secondly, Jay had asked the question about ultrafiltration. It's going to, for those of us that remember the way dialysis used to be done, you ran a blood pump and you put a screw clamp on the venous line, right?
Yep.
And so you're going to have a powerful pump to deal with that pressure rise, but that can be done. They're miniaturized. Victor Gura, for example, has a fantastic miniature pump. It can be done. The ethical issues are over, okay? There are going to be bozos around the world, perhaps here, that are going to be a barrier, but it's over. I would do it for my grandchildren. I'd like to hear just from you guys, would any of you be the buddy?
Sure.
Anyone except you, Tom.
I'm
very intrigued by the. I was thinking, from a pediatric perspective, when you have the disproportionality volume issue, on how effective that would be. And in my mind, I was always debating about one prescription versus the other. But with 2+ million people dying, which is the data you presented, we have to come up with a different game plan. What I'm a little concerned about, and this is a pediatric-centric viewpoint, is that 95% of our kids on chronic dialysis, their endpoint is transplant. So it strikes me that if we go down that pathway, we need to ask the same question, is not in the long run transplant actually cheaper and better? And the answer is it is, but is that not a better investment over allo? Although allo is pretty cool.
I mean, I know there is an extensive discussion going on in the renal community, also in the adult community.
Yeah.
And I think my reading and talking to quite a few people is that going for transplants as the first option, this is poses tremendous strains on the healthcare system because you would need hospitals, you need surgeons, you need donors, you need immunosuppressive drugs. So, but what I could see very well is that allo-HD in resource-limited settings could serve as a bridging. And I think I indicated this, that as a bridging to save time, and then patients could move on to other therapies. Now, coming back to your first point about the volume imbalances, actually, it works very much in favor in kids because with an adult body, the kidneys that have a high, the adult kidneys could remove easily the solutes produced by kids, so that's very favorable setting.
Yeah, there's a question from the audience. What's the development timeline? When do you foresee that animal studies will take place?
Yeah, difficult question, of course. I mean, we will see fairly soon. And when I say fairly soon, it's within a few months bench tests, and then we have to find partners who would want to engage in animal experiments, and then the outcome of these experiments, and we'll determine the next steps.
Okay. I have a question for Dr. Coca about going back to the biomarkers. You did not comment on the ELAINE trial by Zarbok et al., which has suggested that early renal replacement therapy initiation based on biomarkers did reduce mortality, published in JAMA 2016.
Who asked that question? Because, you know, on the plane last night, I was thinking about the ELAINE trial, and I remembered either ELAINE or Akiki had a biomarker enrollment. So I was frantic. I landed, and in my hotel last night, I checked. So here's the issue with the ELAINE. Pull it up, the consort diagram. Yes, NGAL level over 200 was one of the enrollment criteria, along with stage 2 or 3 AKI. There were only three patients who had stage 2 or 3 AKI who did not have an NGAL level over 200. So I was going to put a slide on that, but to me, it was not a biomarker-facilitated enrollment. They were enrolled 97% of the time, 98% of the time, on the already existing clinical criteria. So great question. I wish I had that as an extra slide, but you're shot down.
I have a question to Dr. Golper, because you really have it structured very well. You can really individualize your treatment. How do you arrange this in a way? Are the nurses and the doctors taking care of this? Do you have specialized personnel taking care of all these, let's say, really individual choices which patients are allowed or able to make?
I'm not sure I understood the question.
No, actually, it is more. It's far from standard. Yeah, you give a lot of freedom to the patient. The patient have to understand everything. Yeah? The treatment schedules can sometimes be different than standard. How do they get support to do this? Is it just the doctors and the nursing team, or do you have specific people actually talking to them, visiting them at home?
Now I get it. We have a very structured program. Unfortunately, not all the patients get into that structured program. There is a concept that I actually want people to start thinking about, and that's called the transitional care unit. We're developing one now. I don't necessarily agree with all of the strategies. Tim at Virginia, they're doing that. But we have a structured program. It starts out with outpatient visits to an educator who just happens to be a dietitian, and that's historical, and she has an interest. She has two themes. One is kidney function and what can go wrong, and there potassium issues come up, phosphorus issues. And then the second theme is replacement therapy. First of all, transplant is by far and away the best therapy, but we're talking about, remember, that was my decision too after conservative care, then renal replacement therapy was transplantation versus dialysis. So our patients are funneled down that dialysis pathway because they don't have a choice, all right? So that's how they get there. Then it is imperative that the discussion be in-center versus home. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely that imperative. And then people start getting enthusiastic about home. Then, once they've gone down that pathway, then they go to the home training unit and they visit with those people. And that's where transitional care units will be valuable. So does that sort of answer the question? I have an entire education program that goes from a dietitian to a nurse practitioner to my regular staff nurses, and all that is iterated back and forth with the MD.
Okay. Then we go back to the biomarkers. And the question, which I think is interesting, do the biomarkers have any impact in patients with an underlying CKD?
Do they have any impact on patients?
In patients with an underlying CKD, are they of any use there?
Oh, well, as Tim mentioned, those with these biomarkers are also expressed just at lower levels in those with CKD. So then there is that whole worry of confounding from that. Now, if you have an individual patient, you know their baseline level, they go to a surgery or whatever, and you have a post-op level, then you can look at that delta change and say... you can say yes, then there is a rise, even despite the baseline elevation. So,
there's a whole literature in the 2008, about 2012, on lupus, UTIs, reflux, CKD, that actually have confounding variables on biomarkers. So I agree with Stephen. I think if you have serial data in the same patient, and you knew at status X that patient's biomarker was Y, and then they had some sort of event like a heart surgery or something, and it popped, that's going to be helpful.
But the order of magnitude in AKI is several-fold higher, A. And then, okay. B, when we've looked for formal interactions by baseline CKD level, yes or no, it still retains the associative properties. But again, my debate role was to say, is it clinically useful? And like I said, we need more data. Just one more point on Elaine. The other reason I didn't, even if there was more of a differentiation of who got into Elaine based on the NGAL level, it was positive. But a Kiki and then the latest one of early versus late in New England, I forgot the acronym now, didn't work. And So I think even Elaine was the single center one, and the other two were multi-center. So I think even that therapy of early versus standard initiation of dialysis for AKI is still yet to be proven. There's a question in the back there.
Yeah, please.
Hi, I'm Osama Shami, one of the renal fellows at Mount Sinai. I just had a question for, it's actually a multi-part question for Dr. Golper. So my understanding, I'm going to be the PD home hemo fellow at Sinai, and my idea of PD and home hemodialysis patients is that they're active participants in their care, compared to like the passive, you know, in-center dialysis patients. But are we making our PD patients more passive participants in their care now? For example, you know, we're no longer teaching them, like you said, manual exchanges, you know, from the get-go. Now, for example, we use the Baxter system, which has AMIA, so we can not only monitor their treatment, but remotely change their prescriptions. So they don't really need to do anything except for, like, you know, accept, you know, like the changes. How does our care compare to like China and Hong Kong, where PD is more or less their first choice and they have lower rates of peritonitis?
Well, there are many aspects to that. I'll take just a few of them. With regards to the passivity, I think that's there's a trend. I have to convince my leadership at our program that our failure rate is going to go up because our acceptance rate is far more liberal. So the answer is yes, there is the circumstance that you said where we have a lot of assistance in PD. That's not the norm, but we're doing that. And in a way, that's a decision made by the physician and the patient's family. And if they choose to go that route, so be it. With regards to China or let me just say other countries, everybody needs to improve on infection rate. So I'm not in competition with China. I'm not in competition with the ICANN School of Medicine. My competition is the disease that is hurting my patients versus the care I can give them. And so I'm not going to digress into some competitive issue. I'm going to serve my patients in the best way I can, and I'm going to individualize it. So I'm going to deal with that latter part with that. But you are right about the passivity, but I don't know that that is bad. I think it should be individualized.
Sorry, it's not a question of competition. It's a question of, like, patient recruitment, right? So we tend to recruit more or less the cream of the crop, right, because we want to have patients who are going to stay on the treatment. So my question in regards to China, for example, was that PD first there is their option, and not a question of competing with them, but what can we learn from them in terms of the fact that their PD is their first option and they have one of the lowest rates of peritonitis, for example. So, you know, where...
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Okay. I think, concludes the session. I think I want to thank the faculty for their great talks, the great discussion, also to thank the audience for posing the questions and